This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play, or at Reason.com, and rate and review us while you're there. So over about the past 20 years, I'd say no libertarian thinker has cut a broader or deeper swath than Tyler Cowen. He holds a chair in economics at George Mason University. He's the chairman and general director of the Mercatus Center there as well, a free market think tank. He's the co-founder of the blog Marginal Revolution. He's a 56-year-old New Jersey native who's a regular contributor at Bloomberg and for years read an economic scene column for the New York Times. He's also the host of a podcast called Conversations with Tyler, where he interviews people ranging from Martina Navratilova to Paul Krugman to Dave Barry. And he's the author over the past 20 years of a shelf full of books, including 2000's In Praise of Commercial Culture, 2007's Discover Your Inner Economist, and last year's The Complacent Class. Tyler's work is at once intellectually serious, it's concise, and it's engaging. And his unique perspective yields really fascinating analyses of activities and subjects that most economists ignore. He writes about everything from the literal and figurative price of fame to how globalization empowers poor Mexican folk artists to whether public funding for the arts has actually been much more successful than most free marketers would grant. A recurring theme over the past decade for him is a fear that America and much of the broadly defined West or post-industrial world may have entered a period that he calls the Great Stagnation, in which technological innovation and economic growth have slowed, even as risk-taking and moonshot-style ventures are either demonized or ignored altogether. I sat down to talk with him about his newest book, which is just out. It's called Stubborn Attachments, A Vision for a Society of Free, Prosperous, and Responsible Individuals. It's an unapologetically libertarian argument for what he calls long-term sustainable economic growth, and more importantly, or as importantly, the intellectual and cultural attitudes that are devoted to prosperity and freedom as twin key goals. It's a really provocative, powerful argument for a libertarian America in which the government does less, individuals do more, and the future becomes the object of our dreams rather than a repository of all of our fears. Tyler, thanks for talking to Reason.
Happy to be here.
So you write early on in the book that we need to develop a tougher, more dedicated, and indeed a more stubborn attachment to prosperity and freedom. What do you mean by that, and why do we need to do that now as opposed to 5 years ago or 10 years in the future?
I think of this book as my attempt to defend a free society and give it philosophical underpinnings. If I think of the major books in philosophy over the last few decades, a lot of them haven't done that very well. So you have Robert Nozick, that's a great book, but it's just all about property rights. John Rawls is mainly an argument for redistribution, or some parts of the book are. And it seems to be now the world is moving away from classical liberal ideas, and that case needs to be made anew and very fresh and in a powerful and vital way.
Since 9/11, freedom has seemingly come under attack or under a different type of scrutiny. The idea that, well, you know, maybe a free society, an open society is also one that's more likely to have terrorists fly planes into buildings or to let bad people in. Is that part of the kind of receding of freedom as a core value? Is it really tied to 9/11, or is there something more going on there?
I think it's a kind of perfect storm of negative factors. So the pace of immigration picked up for a while. That made some people very nervous. You had terrorism picking up for a while, globalization reaching some peaks, the rise of China, which is basically an autocratic country, but of course it has done very well for some number of years. And all of those influences coming together and Europe turning back to the right, parts of the Middle East going up in flames. We're right now at a moment where intellectually we're moving away from liberalism.
So, and prosperity as well. I mean, certainly since the early 70s, but especially in the 21st century, we've seen lower than average economic growth. How important is prosperity, not simply to the future, and we'll get to that because that's a central part of your book, but how important is prosperity to kind of the ideals of freedom?
I argue that prosperity is central to most human values. A wealthier world helps you be more creative. It helps you choose a job or a spouse that you might want to have rather than someone you have to marry for, say, the money. It helps us pay our bills. It helps us take care of needier members of society. It just keeps us on track and gives us actually some ability to control our environment and not entirely be at the mercy of nature. So I think prosperity, oddly, is still underrated.
It's underrated, even though everywhere that's what we're always chasing, right? And what has happened? You've written in previous books, including about one called The Great Stagnation or About the Great Stagnation. Is economic prosperity, is robust economic prosperity a thing of the past? And are we learning to manage with, you know, to be smarter with our meager prosperity now?
Well, the rate of productivity growth is down. As you said, economic growth is slower. We take fewer chances. We regulate things with the government too much. Mm-hmm. I think we've lost some parts of an earlier American mentality. Maybe it still exists in the tech sector. But the economy as a whole, productivity growth in a typical year is maybe 1.5%. In an earlier America, it was, say, 3%. It's a big change. And compounded over time, it makes an enormous difference. So people want prosperity, but they're not obsessed with it anymore.
Is that because we don't need to be? I mean, you know, obviously it's always better to be, you know, it's better to make 200 grand than 180 grand. But if you're making 180 grand or 150 or 100 grand, it's not the same as making 10 grand.
Yes, partly we're the victims of our own success. But that's not the only factor. We're also shooting ourselves in the foot. There are many dysfunctional elements in modern American society, and fixing them would boost the rate of economic growth.
Well, before we go on to some of the specifics of your book, let's talk about those. What are the main things that are dragging down prosperity? Which, and one of the things we'll get to is that you're not always talking about this simply in sheer economic or commercial terms. But how are we shooting ourselves in the foot?
Bad K-12 education would be a major problem. Lack of freedom to build in America's major cities would be another problem. Lack of fiscal responsibility. I don't think it's been a problem so far, but I think it will be over the next 10 or 15 years. And in general, just not husbanding our resources very well or making good decisions on infrastructure or having enough interest in risk-taking and science and building like a bigger, bolder, brighter future.
So where in the book, you talk about pluralism and common sense morality. Talk about pluralism first. What do you mean by that, the way that you're using that term? And then talk about common sense morality.
The general meaning of pluralism is simply that there are many values. But I deploy it quite specifically, and that's the notion that a prosperous society does well on most of these values. For instance, the arts, as I've argued in earlier books, or human caring, or cooperation, or civic society. So if a person cares about something more than like just money, or more than just, say, libertarian rights, I think there's nonetheless a strong argument for a society, a polity, that will maximize the rate of economic growth. Again, subject to rights constraints.
Right. And do you feel that we've moved away from pluralism in that sense that, or is maybe that one of the reasons why we're not so focused on the economy anymore?
I think most people will accept pluralism if it's presented to them. But the idea that there's a fairly simple formula for serving plural ends, I think that's where the controversy lies. The idea that economic growth over enough time is better for virtually everyone, we don't emphasize that enough. Again, I think when you present it to people, a lot of them agree. That's one of the main goals of my book. But it's not front and center of most political discussions today. They're often about redistribution or this group's feelings was hurt or, you know, what are we going to do for some specific town in the Midwest? They're not about higher rate of economic growth for the country and the world.
Is that a return to, I think you and I are roughly the same age. We're late baby boomers, if I'm not mistaken. And
yes.
A lot of this sounds like, you know, kind of the late 70s when a writer, political scientist Christopher Lash wrote a book called The Minimal Self, the Psychic Survival in an Age of Diminished Expectations or Diminishing Expectations. Is that, do you feel like we're going back to that idea that, you know what, that the world is not expanding infinitely, or at least America is not. So now, instead of growing the pie, we're more focused on carving it up and taking something off of your plate and putting it on mine or putting it on somebody else's.
Yes, there's more zero-sum thinking. And if you poll young people, sometimes they'll say they prefer socialism to capitalism. Now, I don't think they actually prefer real socialism, but it's nonetheless, to me, a strong negative that the kind of expressive message they want to send is in that direction.
And it is that it's not about expanding. It's not about creating the bright, shiny new thing. It's really about kind of making sure that everybody gets, you know, at least gets enough to get by or to redress some real or imagined historical grievance.
That's right. There was something quite megalomaniacal about some versions of early socialism, and I would not at all endorse the coercive side of it. Mm-hmm. But the notion that socialist countries would outproduce and get to the, you know, capitalism and get to the moon first and do everything better, that's the kind of thinking we've lost, but that comes better from capitalism.
Right. And we're not necessarily doing it now, except, as you said, in the it seems in the tech sector, in many ways. So talk about common sense morality, because, you know, and I will, you know, totally fanboy out right now. I mean, this book is incredibly lucidly written. It's very concise, and it's very persuasive, partly because of the language you use. There's technical dimensions to it, but it's also you're using, you know, common language. What do you mean by common sense morality?
That's a term. It comes from the British philosopher Henry Sidgwick. And it's simply, if you ask ordinary, smart, well-meaning people, you know, how should I live my life? What they will tell you. They'll say, you know, work hard, save some money, marry well, be good to your family, cultivate your friends. That's common sense morality. My book defends common sense morality and also tries to argue that if more people followed it more strictly, that would in fact coincide with this goal of maximizing sustainable economic growth.
So who in America, if you said to them, you know what, you should actually be a bastard to everybody around you, and you should cheat on your wife, and you should be mean to your kids, and you should steal from old people. I mean, nobody really is against common sense morality, are they? Or where is it breaking down in American society?
Well, actual actions are mixed, but if you look at aggregate social indicators for significant parts of America, they're getting worse. For highly educated people, it's clear actually they're getting better. That's a good thing. But for too much of the nation, people seem to be moving away from common sense morality.
And do you think also a kind of pluralism in the sense that maybe not in the sense that they individually have a bundle of goods that they consider, you know, together makes up a good life, but that they don't care about other people's equal access to that kind of searching?
Well, again, I think if you ask people various questions, well, would you agree with what Tyler says here or there?
Yeah.
A lot of them would say, yes, I do. But the notion that you're really going to prioritize economic growth, common sense morality, and leave away what are often the main political concerns of today, most of all egalitarianism, that's where I think the real disagreement lies. And part of my book is just showing, well, if you really believe in economic growth, it has this quite forcing implication that a lot of other values you really shouldn't be pursuing. Pursue them only insofar as they boost sustainable economic growth.
Well, let's talk about sustainable economic growth, because you are not talking, you're at pains to say you're not talking about economic growth in the way that maybe a beleaguered CEO of a corporation who knows if I don't show a really strong profit in the next year, I'm out on my ass, or a politician. You know, said like if we're not doing better at the end of my term, I'm toast. You're talking about sustainable economic growth. What do you mean by that?
Well, you can always boost growth in year one by just eating into your capital. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that over long periods of time, decades and even centuries, that we have the highest growth rate possible. So that will mean high rate of savings, a lot of investment. It will mean taking serious care of some parts of the environment. That's sort of, you know, my message for a lot of conservatives or Republicans or even libertarians. In some ways, maybe we should care about the environment more. And my message for the left is drop this idea of redistribution for its own sake, but, you know, do look for forms of redistribution that are going to boost economic growth.
Well, and you talk about wealth plus. Talk a little bit about what you mean, because that's how we know that economic growth. The idea is that sustainable economic growth, which means that it's you can keep doing it over the long haul. You're not just, you know, lighting fire to everything or dumping a ton of borrowed money into a short term boost or anything like that. That you're not destroying the planet. This wealth plus idea. What is that, and why is that so important?
Well, economists usually focus on GDP as a measure of wealth, and for a lot of purposes, that's fine. But Wealth Plus says, for kind of doing ultimate philosophy, you need to think about people's leisure time, which is not counted in GDP, and you need to think about the environment, which at least at times is not counted in GDP. So think of it as modified and improved GDP. For a lot of purposes, it will behave in the same way.
Now, do you feel like, you come back to the environment a number of times, and just in this conversation, are we really not taking care of the environment? Because by virtually all indicators, at least in the United States, there are more trees than there used to be. The water is cleaner, the air is cleaner, and things like that. What more do we need to be doing to take care of the environment?
Well, wealthier societies generally do a better job with the environment, and this gets us back to pluralism. But I do worry about carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. There's an issue of biodiversity. I'm not sure how worried we should be about that, but I don't think we should simply ignore it. But I agree on most environmental dimensions, wealthier societies have done by far the better job.
So, and then it's a question of how do you bring the developing world up to those standards without, because again, there's a pluralistic belief going on here, without completely destroying their possibilities of economic growth.
That's right. You know, as it stands, 6 to 7 million people die each year due to air pollution. And I don't mean like carbon and global warming. I just mean plain old ordinary air pollution. And that's mostly in the poorer countries. And simply having those places become wealthier will give them the resources, desire, and ability to mostly solve those problems. That's an incredible tragedy. And it's hardly ever played up in the evening news.
Do you identify as libertarian?
I call myself a small L libertarian. Okay. So non-libertarians think I am one. A lot of libertarians insist I'm not.
One of the reasons I was asking that is because, you've talked about the environment in a way that oftentimes libertarians do, along with conservatives, and occasionally they tend mostly to be in Europe, in my experience, but some leftists who are like, screw the environment. You know, we live for today, not for 1,000 years when, you know, we may or may not exist as a species. But a lot of libertarians chafe at anything that's related to improving the environment or paying for that. But you also talk about wealth transfers as part of common sense morality. Talk about what do you mean? What is a good vision, a stubborn attachment that would allow for economic freedom and prosperity and individual rights, but would also include transfers of wealth to people who need help?
Well, I've seen numerous public health programs around the globe that have remedied, say, malnutrition in poor children, and I think help those societies grow at a more rapid clip, help them become closer to the rule of law and more democratic, mm-hmm. and just made them nicer places. So I don't feel we should condemn those. Quite to the contrary, we should applaud them. But I don't believe in just tearing down wealthy people to give poor people more money. It seems to me some redistribution is a really good investment.
So, and how much, you're at pains to talk about, you know, that you believe in the book, that it's kind of self-evident, and that we all know this, that there are things such as right and wrong, and there are better and worse ways to do things. We may not always agree, and we may not always know, but this is not a book that where you're trying to argue a specific point of good or bad, but rather it's, in general, we all agree.
That's right.
Helping people. And it is interesting, within kind of libertarian economics, say, do you think something has kind of gone off where somebody like Milton Friedman who obviously introduced the idea of school vouchers and the idea of bringing market forces and market competition to bear in K through 12, mandatory K through 12 education, in order to improve it and make it better, particularly for the least served among us. But he never really questioned the idea that the government would be paying for education. That is seen in certain libertarian circles, or rather, do you think that is seen as more of a heretical position now than it used to be when you were coming up through grad school?
I think the whole debate over vouchers is up for grabs at the moment. In the data, they've underperformed relative to expectations. I'm not sure what to make of that, whether you need to do it on a broad national market level, or if it's just, well, remixing the same kids into the private sector doesn't get you much advantage.
I guess what I was saying, though, is more it's the question of libertarians seeming to become more willing to kind of play act at being anarchists and saying, you know, the real problem isn't the delivery, system of education, but rather it's the real problem is the state taking money from other people to educate other people's kids. Do you have a sense that libertarian kind of policymaking has gone from being what was, you know, a more Friedmanite kind of presumption that the government was going to be doing a lot of stuff to one that now leans tips more anarchistic?
I guess I see libertarianism on net as moving closer to Republicans, which I think is bad, and less anarchistic. But I think you're better informed on this than I am. I think homeschooling's great. We should do, you know, what we can to encourage it at the margin. I don't think there'll be like a single answer to the best schooling policy, but I'm quite sure we're not at it now.
Yeah.
And the correct answer will involve like more freedom, more experimentation.
Do you, well, and you talked to go back to wealth transfers in general, you say, you know, you want them, but only up to a point, and that point is where they diminish growth. That, you know, I don't have a problem with that as a classical liberal. I accept, you know, the idea of, you know, that the state is going to be providing stuff and is going to be taking some money from, you know, those of us who are better off and giving it to those of us who are worse off. How do you know when that line, when transfers start to diminish growth, both conceptually, but then kind of empirically? How can we draw that with any precision whatsoever?
I don't think it's very exact, but I think we know Western European societies are past that line. I think we have a good sense that East Asian societies, these wealthy ones such as Singapore, are not past that line. U.S. growth rates have fallen, but I tend to think that more has to do with regulation than with too much redistribution. But I would say that's somewhat of an open question.
And then how do you go from, and I realize, you know, this is a book that is ultimately about kind of deep politics, or it's almost like the grammar through which partisan politics or electoral politics would play out. But how do you go from, one of the other things you talk about in the book in terms of transfers is that you say we're investing way too much in old people relative to young people. And that's primarily a function, and this is not a particularly original thought, but it's one that is definitely worth confronting and repeating all the time. It's because old people vote. How do you flip that script? I mean, we're never going to get young people to vote in large enough numbers, and then they might be just as kind of rapacious and greedy as old people. How do we flip the script so that we're not talking about which class, however we define them, just gets to vote themselves more of other people's money?
I'm not sure we'll flip it until we run out of money, which will happen. But when that day comes, you know, American society does at critical moments sometimes make the right decisions, even when ex ante it may appear hopeless. So, you know, we got rid of slavery and we've done many other wonderful things. And if we're in there, you know, with the better ideas and the time comes where we need to flip that switch, I think there's some chance we do. No guarantees, of course.
You, throughout the book, you give a couple of shout outs to Ayn Rand. And it's interesting to me, partly because I work at Reason, which was named or was created by a person who was interested in objectivism. Reason is central. The faculty of reason is what makes humans humans, per Rand and following Aristotle. You talk about her or you laud her for emphasizing the role of production in a good society. What do you mean by that? Because you write that a lot of people seem to take, kind of the productivity of modern society for granted.
In her book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, she makes this point quite clearly. And actually, Camille Paglia made it much later. The idea that wealth is the foundation for the creative individual human mind, and wealth gives creative independence, and wealth enables us to interact as freestanding cooperative individuals. It may be trivial to many of our listeners, but still, those are vastly underrated points in contemporary intellectual discourse.
Yeah, why do you think so many economists even, forget about philosophers, just kind of take for granted the idea that we will always have a lot of stuff around us?
Well, especially if you're an academic, you're not involved with producing it in a direct way. You tend to forget about it. You like to play games with other people's money. And I think it's a sickness of American society that we've forgotten where it comes from. Some of that itself comes from the fact that we are now wealthier than we used to be. But we need to relearn that.
Is that that sounds a lot like Joseph Schumpeter as well, that we become wealthy and we take it for granted and then we start kind of pissing it away as a culture and as individuals.
And too many people are in bureaucratized jobs, so they think of the world as like a big bureaucracy. Hmm. It's also a Schumpeterian point.
Are you more optimistic about the future than you were during your great stagnation years, or are you merely more desperate?
I would say my forecast of the variance has increased. So I've seen a lot of technological advances since I wrote Great Stagnation in 2011. They're not all quite brought to fruition, like, say, driverless cars, but they've come closer to reality than I think we all had been expecting. But at the same time, I look at politics, not just in the U.S., but in Turkey, in China, in Russia, in Hungary, in Poland, maybe in Brazil, and discourse seems a lot worse. So my worst case scenario has deteriorated too.
What, beyond somebody like Rand, you mentioned in the book as well that you're a fan of science fiction, and you come back to a couple of motifs, including the kind of butterfly effect stories where people can go back in time, or histories that record some small, seemingly insignificant event that completely changed the course of human history. Besides Rand, who were your intellectual or cultural influences growing up?
Well, I played a lot of chess early on, and that was maybe the single biggest influence, because when you play chess and you lose, you have no excuses. So you're always trying to get better feedback, and you tend not to blame other people. And I also played chess for money as a kid, not enormous sums, but the idea that like no one owed me a living. I learned early on, and that you can support yourself.
Did you only play chess because of Bobby Fischer beating Boris Spassky? Are you a Cold War baby without acknowledging it?
Fully, I started at age 10. Yeah. I had my appendix out in the hospital, and heard about Bobby Fischer and so on.
I hope, you're holding up better than him, right? His career arc was went beyond stagnation to true kind of psychological degradation. Who else? And why did you become an economist?
Oh, I think I was 13 years old. My father brought home a periodical called The Freeman, published by Foundation for Economic Education. And I read some of that. It intrigued me. But it was sort of too simple. So I went to the public library. I read some Milton Friedman, some Hayek. I think I was 14. I read Adam Smith. Rand, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, had a huge impact on me. I never bought into the whole system of Rand with the epistemology and, altruism is bad. I never agreed with. But this emphasis on capitalist producers, it seemed to me, that really was what made the world go round. So that was pretty early in my life. And it all had a big influence on me.
It sounds like you blended that pretty seamlessly with a Hayekian emphasis on the limits of knowledge as well. I mean, one of the themes of the book is simultaneously one of the reasons why we should give people more space to live the way they want to is because we don't really know what is right, and that kind of underwriting a lot of different experiments in living is is the right thing to do, given our relative lack of knowledge.
Yes, and I encourage people to be fallibilists. So even the arguments in my book, of course, I agree with them. But always be asking yourself, it's like in chess, like, what am I getting wrong? In chess, most of your moves are wrong. We learn this by playing computers. So you can be world champion, most of your moves are wrong. And that's a very startling observation that we should take more seriously.
Yeah, at one point in the book, you suggest a kind of an aside that macroeconomics, the great god macroeconomics, may have reached its epistemic limit. What do you mean by that?
It's very hard to make good macroeconomic forecasts. Obviously, there's always someone calling they'll be for a recession, and ex post they turn out to be right. But a consistent ex ante forecasting track record, very hard to come by. And again, that reminds us of the limits of our knowledge.
And do you think it's getting, I mean, I guess macroeconomics in particular, or kind of a large synthesized understanding of how complicated, first, you know, obviously the economy, the global economy, any local economy, a household economy is infinitely complicated, it seems, that we go through phases where the theories seem to explain what's going on, and then we just get to a point where nothing's quite making sense anymore.
Right. Like, I think monetarist theory, Keynesian, Austrian, they've all been partly correct at different points in time. And no one group likes it when I say that, but no one of them is a general theory either. And again, you try to ask, oh, when's the next recession coming? I genuinely have no idea. And I read and think about this question literally every day of my life.
So how does this book, you know, I started out by asking you, you know, why now? I mean, clearly this is a book that is primed, and I was going to say for the Trump era, but it's not simply Donald Trump who is asserting a kind of certitude about what is right or what is good, or that he will be able to, you know, turn back the waves. I mean, there's also that among his opponents. Are we in a particularly, and when thinking back to your childhood, when you're, you know, learning chess, when you're going through the 70s, when you're reading Ayn Rand or science fiction, are we in a particularly brittle moment in American society?
It's certainly possible. I mean, you can think of maybe Obama is like John Quincy Adams. He was very intellectual, very pro-government, very cosmopolitan. And then, you know, come 1828, the nation rejects that and opts for Andrew Jackson. And I think in 1828, few people really had a sense of what would be coming over the next 30, 40 years. And I wonder if today is not another 1828 moment.
Yeah. Well, that is certainly not a happy thought.
The Civil War is just terrible, right?
Right.
You have awful things happen, but a lot of amazing things happen, too. You know, the telegraph is invented and canals and railroads knit the nation together and we get these new states and America becomes the America we know, but it's also bloody and brutal. So I suspect, again, we're entering this high variance period where politics will matter more than at least I would like it to. But there's also a lot of opportunities on the table that didn't appear to be there 5-10 years ago.
And it seems, I mean, you would agree that, I think we have professionally been kind of interacting for about 20 years or something like that. I mean, the world in many ways is unimaginable from say 1998 or something like that. When you think of the kind of whiz bang technology that we have, the ease of communication, the fact that we're recording a broadcast quality thing where you're in Virginia, I'm in New York, and people are listening to it anywhere in the world. At what point does politics ruin that? Is there a tripwire that we can watch out for where it's, you know, the politics gets to a point where it actually diminishes the ability of people to live their lives in America?
You know, I guess my modal prediction, which I would be very cautious about, is not some new age of totalitarianism or fascism, but that the center doesn't hold and a lot of governments in ways they become too weak and there's simply a lot of uncertainty and they kind of lunge at a lot of things in ill-conceived ways and volatility and political risk go up for most people and that makes our lives worse. But the old kind of Orwellian libertarian nightmare of this encroaching big brother, I don't think that's what we're seeing right now. You know, the rhetoric in some ways does not correspond to the reality. The reality is that governments spend most of their money on old people and can't perform a lot of basic functions and are dysfunctional. And I don't quite think they're going to enslave us. They may make our lives too risky in some ways.
Do you, one of the things that has always marked your career as distinct from virtually any other economist that I think of is that you always were interested in thinking about culture and looking at the economic forms of that. Your book, Creative Destruction, looked at the effects of globalization on kind of on culture and on kind of a thick human life. What tipped you in that direction?
You know, I had personal interests in music, the arts, cinema, and just being selfish and kind of short-sighted in a way, I thought I should incorporate this into my work so I can always be working, and that will make me much more productive. And that worked out very well for me, but it was really a kind of petulant selfishness.
Are you, I highly recommend Creative Destruction, a book which came out, what, about 20 years ago now? Is that right?
Maybe a little less, but around
that. 2000 or so. You, in many ways, are a what Donald Trump would call pejoratively a globalist, in that you believe in an international order. You believe in, you know, the idea of kind of open borders and a lot of transfer of goods and people and knowledge and things like that. What is the globalist answer to the nationalist or the populist who says, you know, that, you know, when if you're a globalist, you don't care about the people who are in your actual communities? And is that important? I mean, how do you put that back in, or how do you put that in terms of the phrases like common sense, morality, and pluralism that you use in your book?
I think globalism works better when more people pursue common sense morality. Just one example, if you look at Utah, which the state is about half Mormon, Utah has quite an intact middle class and robust economic growth, and it's pretty well run. It's not that I think everyone should become a Mormon. I'm not a Mormon myself, but it does show there's some kind of moral, cultural foundation for capitalism. It's not that I think everyone has to live a particular way, but you need some middle class core in a society doing that, if only to support the people who really wish to deviate. And I would say the world as a whole is growing at well over 4%, basically at its highest rate ever. There's been more poverty alleviation in the last 20 years than any other time in human history ever by a long amount. And it is true, some of the middle class in this country has been hurt or ceased to see income growth. We ought to acknowledge that. But I think mainly it's been an era of incredible triumphs, and now we're seeing some backlash.
So how much of the argument that you're making is necessary, and how much of the conversation in the United States are we having? The world is growing richer, as you were saying, and certainly at the very bottom, the number of people coming out of absolute poverty, whether you know, however defined, is immense. There is a global middle class that's emerging in a way that, again, is really almost unimaginable 20 or 25 years ago. How much is it that we're having a conversation without acknowledging a relative decline of America's fortunes relative to the rest of the world? I mean, are we in a position like England and France, maybe Germany and Japan after World War II, where we don't quite want to admit that we're not the only thing on the block anymore?
Sure, that's absolutely true. But America still is the world's number one power, mm-hmm. and still has a lot of soft power and a great deal of influence. So it's not like the British Empire that went from, you know, a quarter of the world to this quite small place, which is now even probably Brexiting from the European Union. We can be the world's number one country for a long time to come, or at the very worst, number two or top three.
Well, and that's so it means like Babe Ruth in his last couple of years. Like maybe he wasn't the best, but he was still pretty good. He was, you know, and batting third in the Yankees lineup or something. What is the—
His last year was with the Boston Braves, though.
Yes,
we don't want to be that.
No.
But the U.S. can be the world's best country and still number one cultural military power. English is the world's language for a long, long time. We have sort of the best geography. We're removed from potential enemies. Mm-hmm. Mexico and Canada, to me, are great neighbors. We have so many pluses. If we screw it up, it's just going to be our own fault.
Talk as a final point. You talked about soft power, and that involves not just kind of cultural power, but also economic power and things like that. What is the essence of the positive side of American soft power? What is the kind of soul of that we should really be I don't want to quite say exporting, but that's what we should be trafficking in as we go into the future.
That people see capitalism as something alluring and rewarding and also fun. I wouldn't quite call it gender equality. I don't see gender equality, say, in Hollywood movies, but some notion that women should be much freer than they are in much of the world you get from American soft power. And just this idea of dynamism and jazz music and rap in so many forms, that you have a nation united by an idea of these multiple ethnicities that's so fantastic, and we've made it work and become world's cultural leader that way. A lot of people just love that and should love it. And, you know, I say all the more, let's bring it on.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Tyler Cowen. His latest book is Stubborn Attachments, A Vision for a Society of Free, Prosperous, and Responsible Individuals. Tyler, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you very much, Nick. Take care.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or at Google Play or at Reason.com and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.